The title of this talk is Own It. Own It. And so oh, thanks, Bob. Yeah, the backhoe is just a little icy out there. And so that'll be a self-explanatory when we get toward the end here. So I think that all of us, you know, come to Zen practice in our own way. We come to Zen practice through different doors, with different aims and different ideas about what Zen practice means. We might use the same words to describe it, but the meaning of those words, you know, what we imagine, what we feel, what we believe we're aiming for, is a little different for each of us. And after all, you know, we're all unique people, all unique beings with our own unique conditioning. So in the same way, we all, I think, practice in different ways. From the outside, it looks like we're all doing the same thing in the Dharma room. And I suppose, you know, you could argue that we are. You know, we're all practicing Zen meditation. But inside of us, different things are happening. I don't think it's too far-fetched to say that the ways we experience ourselves, our bodies, our thoughts, our breath, are different for each of us, and also different within ourselves at different times. So how we do Zen differs among us and changes within ourselves as time goes by. Now, we all know there are meditation techniques, strategies, methods. Some of these are called mind practices. So here are some of them that most of you are familiar with. Following our breath, counting our breath, mantra practice, Wado practice, practicing with a koan, shikantaza, or just sitting, chanting, bowing. We're all familiar with those forms of practice. And there are group guidelines for how we practice, too, in a formal setting. You know, we keep silence, and we practice something called together action. So we work together to help each other and support each other. All these methods and techniques are important. They're time-tested, and some of them are very simple. And despite being simple, we can use them for our whole entire lives in some cases in this great work that we're doing, waking up, cutting through suffering, and living a life with wisdom as much as we can. There is another aspect of practice, however, that is less straightforward and squishier than the fundamental techniques I just mentioned. And that I'm referring to as attitude. It's the attitude we bring to our practice. For example, things like our sense of determination and the energy we bring to our practice. And for the sake of discussion, I'm going to divide how attitude forms into two parts. One is sort of the conscious aspects of our attitude, like our aspirations, and the things we tell ourselves about how we practice and how we should practice. And then there are less conscious or even unconscious influences like our lifelong conditioning and our personality, which one could say is in part a result of conditioning. All of these characteristics affect how we practice, consciously and unconsciously. We put our own spin on Zen practice. So I wrote down some adjectives that might describe some of the ways we come to practice or engage in practice. We might aim to be calm. We might be ambitious or uncertain, fearless, anxious, driven, confident, doubtful, grandiose, uncertain. I think I said that one. Consistent, inconsistent. Stubborn, passive, you know, the list is virtually endless for how we feel, how we come at practice in ways that we're aware of and in ways that we're not. Today, I want to focus on the conscious or potentially conscious intentional aspects of how we approach Zen. And again, I'm calling this our attitude toward practice. So here's a story. My very first Zen teacher was a Japanese-American guy from Hawaii. His name was Tanoue Sensei. He's gone now. I think he died around 2000, maybe a little before. So he was. I was practicing in an Aikido club long ago, and he was invited to this club here in Seattle. And the first time was in 1979. I think he came for two weekend workshops, so each lasting 2 days, and I think they were both in 1979. And before one of these workshops started, the night before, he gave a talk. And, you know, us Aikido people were there listening. We called him Sensei because he was, in addition to being a Zen teacher, he was also a martial arts guy and a musician. So he gave this talk and people asked questions. And he, at one point, described what he considered to be the differences in the way Soto practitioners approach Zen and the way Rinzai people do. He said that Soto practitioners are people who are like people who sit patiently looking up at the sky and waiting for the clouds to part. And when they finally do and the moon appears, they say, oh, there it is. Rinzai people, on the other hand, are the ones that are trying to wave the clouds away. So as you might guess, he was a Rinzai person. And those retreats were hard. You were not supposed to move. So there's more than one way. And doesn't mean one way is better than the other. But there are different ways. And there's different advice we receive. As you now no doubt have received some of it. About the attitude we should take. So here are some recommendations from various teachers. Some of which we might be aware of and recognize. Zen Master Sun Tzu frequently said, try 10,000 years nonstop. Yeah. And also from him is, just do it, you know, which is another way of saying, don't check. Don't check your practice. Just, he would say, go straight, don't know. Many of you know that a 3-day retreat like the one we're participating in right now is called a Yangming Zhang Jin, which means to leap like a tiger while sitting. So that kind of says it right there, you know, this attitude. Ann Popesneem, you've heard her say, sit like your hair is on fire. So those are all pretty strong messages, okay, for, you know, kind of a energetic practice. And we're, you know, the last one I wrote down was, you know, practice with courage or great courage, great courage. As we look into ourselves. I want to talk about a particular attitude that I think bears some attention. In spite of whatever teaching we receive, over time, and depending on what you might expect when you start practicing, practice can become frustrating. It might become difficult, or it might be boring. Or it might seem pointless. And maybe you've stuck with it for some time. And, you know, months or maybe years go by, and it might seem as if nothing has changed. Or maybe we encounter problems in our life which Zen meditation just can't seem to touch. It's not fixing our lives the way we had hoped or imagined. Maybe we were expecting some clear result that never materialized. And the techniques and methods that we use might seem inadequate or ineffective. And maybe, therefore, we start to doubt ourselves and doubt our practice. In my experience, and I'm just going to say, give my opinion, instruction in Zen practice never seems particularly precise or formulaic. There is instruction, but there's no clear formula to follow, as in, if you do this, you're going to get this. Yeah, do it this way and only this way. That is the way. Zen is more like making soup than baking croissants. You know, with cooking, you've got some wiggle room, they say, except for in baking. In baking, you're supposed to follow things precisely. So Zen is like making soup, not so much like baking. I was discussing this with someone the other day, And they said something I thought was wise. They said, there's no prescription. There's no prescription. No precise prescription. And yesterday, somebody described a practice when I was talking with them as intangible, which I thought really hit the mark. So to a large degree, even when we're working with a teacher, we're left on our own to sort out the details for ourselves. And this can leave us feeling adrift in our practice or wondering whether we're doing it right and whether we're even suited to Zen practice. So here is the good news. Here's what I think about that. It's in these kinds of states or with these kinds of thoughts and feelings where we can reach a turning point, an important turning point in our practice. From a point like this one, we can take ownership of our practice and instill it with new energy. It becomes less about subscribing to a tradition or to forms or to a formula or a prescription, and more about finding our own way, even while remaining inside and following the structure of Zen that Zen Buddhism provides, like retreats like this one. It still can look the same on the outside, but be changed and possibly more powerful on the inside. And we can describe that as taking responsibility for our practice and taking responsibility for our life. Many of you, if not most, have read at least some of Dropping Ashes on the Buddha. And if so, you might recall the entry entitled, My Dharma is Too Expensive. Which is, it's hard to forget that one if you've read it. A student asked Zen Master Hyang Bong to teach them the Dharma. And Hyang Bong says, my Dharma is too expensive. Too expensive for you. So he goes away, and over many months of practice, the student returns several times to Hyang Bong and offers some form of payment so that he can receive the teacher's Dharma. You all know how it goes. He offers his money, his very life, his mind, his cuts, shout. And in each case, Hyang Bong tells him, no, my Dharma is still too expensive. Finally, after a deep awakening, the student comes back to Hyang Bong and presents his insight. But again, Hyang Bong tells him his Dharma is even more expensive than that. And so the student becomes furious, tells Hyang Bong he can shove his Dharma up his ass, and turns to leave. And that's when Hyang Bong tells him, don't lose my Dharma. Yeah. That, to me, is just a great story and a really poignant one. And I note that it's really early on in the book. It's like third or fourth. It's on page 8. So an important message to get early on, I think. So this talks about, you know, taking responsibility, making it ours. And you know, as the saying goes, deciding for ourselves whether the tea is hot or cold. Here's another story, this one about me from my own experience. So between 8 and 10 years ago, I did some 2-week retreats by myself out at Jeff Tip Popesneem's cabin on Vashon Island. And the first one was in 2016. And I'd prepared, you know, I'd consulted with my teachers, I planned out my menu, I got all my food, all my cooking stuff, you know, so I didn't have to buy any food, just 2 weeks of practice. You know, I was really set up. But the day before I left to go out there, I went to work and I had an argument with somebody at work, with an officer at work. And he had some authority over how I did things because he kind of ran the unit where I was going to. And he misused his authority and prevented me from beginning my work for a couple of hours, you know, which put me behind for the day. And I thought it was really wrong. And I was so angry. And I took that anger with me out to Vashon Island the next day. And it preoccupied me for days and days. I know that because I was taking notes. I was keeping a journal. When I looked at this journal in the past, I was like, man, this really stuck with me. So my usual ways of practicing were not helping me get past this. You know, I wasn't able to cut through it and settle down and relax. All I had was this all this anger. And that's not what I had in mind for how the retreat should go. So I decided eventually that I needed to try new things, because what I was doing and what I ordinarily did was not helping. And I had to try really hard. And in the process of doing that, I came away with sort of a new attitude. I realized that I could, in a sense, teach myself how to practice in a way that was effective for my problems, my karma. And so instead of depending on some prescribed teaching or method, I took greater ownership of my practice. I recognized a problem and tried to figure out a way to meditate that cut through it. And so I made it mine. And when I came back, that's what I had in my mind. I said, I made it mine, and I had this advice, which I will repeat again now. If my advice to you is, make it yours. Make Zen inquiry your own inquiry. And this is not to say that we should reject teachings or our teachers. And I wouldn't advise that. And it doesn't mean that the support of the Sangha, of the community, becomes irrelevant. It does mean that we take responsibility for our practice and investigate our nature with the determination that we all have within us. It might be latent. It might be hidden. But it's there. We understand we can't depend on someone else to build this raft to take us to the other shore. No one can do it for us. And this is not arrogance. You know, if you start feeling like, it's all me, you know, or start feeling smug, it's not that. It's not like, you know, the temple rules say. It's not, you know, I already have great understanding. This approach involves looking deeply at ourselves and depending on ourselves and our own experience in order to wake up. So where are you going? Own it. And don't despair. You're not alone. The Sangha's help and support are always available. But you can help yourself and help this world by tapping into your inherent capabilities. And for me, this takes a lot of effort. And maybe for you too. But we can do it. And as has been said before, I think by me too, we already have everything we need to do this. One last story. 8 days ago, a few of us attended a memorial service for Jeff Tipp, Jita Pope's name. It was held at the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island. And the Puget Sound Zen Center, the guiding teacher there is Koshin Kane. And he told a story about Jeff meeting Robert Aitken Roshi. As the story goes, Jeff boldly asked Aitken Roshi, "What is Zen?" To which Aitken Roshi replied, "Confidence." When Koshin told this story, it wasn't what I had expected the answer would be. But it's one that I hope I won't forget. So may you practice with energetic determination and with confidence. And do that for all beings. So thank you for your training, and thanks for being here.